This is a reading of a set of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Bees, given to the workmen. Lecture 2 was given in Dornach, November 28, 1923. Good morning, gentlemen. Has any question come to mind that you would still like to ask me? At this point, someone reads aloud an article printed in the Swiss Apiculture Newsletter, New Series Numbers 2 and 3, February and March, 1923. The article by Professor Buttel Riepen is entitled, Can Bees See Colors Invisible to Human Beings? Dr. Steiner. Let's talk about this a bit. These experiments, carried out by Forel, as well as Kuhn and Pohl, demonstrate clearly how thoughtlessly such experiments are conducted at the present time. Footnote, Auguste-Henri Forel, 1848-1931, a Swiss psychiatrist and natural scientist, who wrote, among other things, titled The Psychic Capabilities of Ants, 1901, and titled How Insects Live Through Their Senses, 1910, Alfred Kuhn, 1885-1968, a German zoologist who wrote and compiled titled An Outline of General Zoology, 1922, no information on Pohl. End of footnote. You cannot imagine anything more absurd than the manner in which this experiment is interpreted. Simply consider for a moment that I could also interpret it in the following way. Assume, for instance, I have a substance, such substances do exist, that is particularly sensitive to ultraviolet light. By that I mean those colors in the color spectrum that lie beyond the visible blue and violet colors. Take as a specific example the substance mentioned in the article, the acid salt hexacyanoplatinate. The latter will give off light, even if I have darkened all the colors of the visible spectrum. Page 163, table 4, upper left. For this purpose, I create a device that will eliminate red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, so that they will not be visible. As a result, I will have here the so-called ultraviolet rays, which are invisible to the human eye. If I put this chemical compound, hexacyanoplatinate, a white powder, where it will be exposed to these rays in a darkened room, then it will begin to phosphoresce. As human beings, we can see nothing in this completely darkened room, but now we allow light rays to enter. At this point, we apply the device to remove the visible spectrum, thereby allowing only ultraviolet rays to enter. But when I place the hexacyanoplatinate where the rays should fall, what happens? Then this substance, quote-unquote, sees. The whole procedure would be about the same if you were to use ants for an experiment instead. Rather than taking hexacyanoplatinate, I take ants. Ants are attracted to sugar. As a result, I say to myself that they can see. But they do not have to see the sugar to find it, just as little as the hexacyanoplatinate needs to be able to see in order to begin glowing and giving off light. All I can assert now is only that when I have a certain substance, it has an effect on ants. More than that, I am not permitted to maintain and say is true. The learned scientists who wrote the article are extremely careless in their thinking, and are asserting such things as can be considered only pure fantasy. The only possible assertion that can be maintained is that something did affect these insects through their sense organs to a greater or lesser degree. The scientists in the article proved that no more stimulation of the insects took place when they lacquered their eyes shut, but it was typical for them to apply by analogy to ants and wasps what they had noticed in working with bees. This demonstrates how carelessly such experiments are carried out. To this we can still add the following point. If you continue going in this direction, see drawing below, also table 4, upper left, you will come to the so-called ultraviolet rays. Here we have red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and then, still further, indigo and violet. There, pointing to the left side, we have the infrared rays, and there, pointing to the right side, the ultraviolet rays. These ultraviolet rays possess the peculiar property, as stated in the article, of having a very strong chemical effect. Whatever you place in the vicinity of these ultraviolet rays will be very strongly affected through a chemical process. As a result of this, if I expose an ant to these rays, it is immediately affected by them. The ant senses them. That statement is true. The ant senses them primarily through its eyes. For the ant, being exposed to the ultraviolet rays creates a feeling as if someone were tickling it. It is the same with a hexacyanoplatinate that is affected when it is placed in the realm of chemical activity. If I draw the shades in a room and allow only the ultraviolet rays to enter, the fact is that the ant notices immediately that something is happening here. Specifically, if you had ant eggs with larvae there in that room, they would undergo a complete change. They would die wherever such a strong chemical effect was being produced. That is why ants, in an otherwise dark room, will move their eggs away from the ultraviolet rays in order to save them. Well, what it really boils down to in this article is a chemical reaction. That which I mentioned recently in another lecture is certainly correct. Bees have a kind of sense organ that combines the characteristics of smell and taste and lies somewhere in the middle between the two. This is what the bees sense. With the ants, it is similar. These gentlemen are so unaware of what really is involved that they do not even know that, for example, when human beings sense colors in their eyes, beginning with the visible violet rays, small chemical reactions take place. Here you can see that the perception of colors in human beings tends to go in the direction of chemical processes. You can say that everything that was examined with regard to the bees can be reduced to the process of bringing about an inner chemical reaction in the bees when they live in an environment that exposes them to ultraviolet light. Now consider the fact that bees can perceive everything in the area of black, white, yellow, gray, simply a dark white, and blue-green. Table 4, upper middle. There is, after all, no ultraviolet in all these colors. Because of this, they do not sense the strong chemical reaction that takes place when they come into the presence of ultraviolet light. When a bee leaves an area of black, white, yellow, and blue-green, and moves into an ultraviolet area, it senses something strange about which it can do nothing. The main consideration here is that the bee has a combination sense of smell and taste. It is true that we make a clear distinction between smelling and tasting. Tasting for us is primarily a chemical sense. It is based completely upon chemical processes. But the bee has a sense that lies midway between smelling and tasting. There is no objection perceived in the fact that a bee can distinguish colors, as exhibited when its hive is painted a specific color that it recognizes. Consider that each color creates a different chemical reaction and is a different degree of warmth. Table 4, lower left. If you were to color a surface red and a bee were to approach it, the bee would feel the warmth of the color. How then is it not possible for this bee to have a different feeling when it comes upon a blue color? Table 4, lower middle. On a blue surface it is colder. The bee senses the warmth of the red and the coldness of the blue. This much it can distinguish. But from this you may not logically deduce that this bee sees with its eyes in the same way human beings do. That would be complete nonsense. That is the way it is with many other things that people do. I have already pointed out to you in which direction all these experiments are going. I have told you that there is a certain plant, the Venus flytrap, that immediately closes its leaves when they are touched. The same way you make a fist when someone wants to touch or hit you, so also does the Venus flytrap wait for an insect to come near it, and then snaps its leaves together. Now people say that this plant, the Venus flytrap, has a soul, just like humans. It perceives when the insect arrives, snaps its leaves together, and so on. Then I always answer, I know of a self-acting mechanism that is constructed in such a way that if an animal approaches it and touches some part of it, this mechanism closes immediately, and the animal is caught. This is what you call a mousetrap. If you ascribe a soul to the Venus flytrap, then logically you must say the same thing about the mousetrap. If you credit bees with a sense of sight, simply because you observe them acting in a certain way in ultraviolet light, then you must likewise ascribe the same sense of sight to the chemical compound hexacyanoplatinate, which can also, so to speak, see. If people truly would think, then they would come upon some very remarkable observations, because hexacyanoplatinate is an extraordinarily interesting compound, consisting, among other things, of barium. This is a white metal belonging to the category of alkaline earth. It is also interesting that such metals play a certain role in human life. We would not, as human beings, be able to have in our physical bodies the proper effect of the proteins, as contained in the egg whites we eat, if it were not for the presence of such metals in our pancreas. These metals must be there. In barium, we have something that is related to the pleasant feelings we experience in the process of digestion. Platinum, as you know, is a particularly valuable metal, a precious metal that is especially hard and heavy. These metals all possess the characteristic that they, in turn, are connected to that which is called feeling or sensing. Let me remind you of something else. In this compound, there is also cyanide. That is a certain kind of hydrocyanic acid salt, which is also called prussic acid. Now, I have told you before that a human being always develops a certain kind of prussic acid right where the muscles are used. Footnote, see lecture titled Über Blausäure und Stickstoff, Kohlensäure und Sauerstoff, October 10, 1923, entitled Mensch und Welt, das Wirken des Geistes in der Natur, Über die Bienen, GA 351, not published in English. End of footnote. So we can say that this entire compound is rather similar to those substances that a human being continuously creates in the body. From this you can see that even a human being is extremely sensitive to the chemical processes that take place in ultraviolet light, specifically in the chemical components of light. This sensitivity is registered in the entire body, not in the eyes. Thus, it is possible for us to judge this matter properly only if we pay close attention to these matters. Only with the help of anthroposophic science will we be led to observe such things as the fact that when hexacyanoplatinate is particularly affected by light, one type of feeling is taking place there. The intensity of this type of activity is present to the greatest degree in bees. Bees sense the colors with particular intensity and see dimly luminous colors when other beings emitting light appear in the vicinity. That is why I continue to say that, in general, a bee experiences only dim conditions around itself. If, however, a new queen bee appears on the scene, then the other bees experience the queen bee as a phosphorescent source, very much as we can experience glowworms on a June night. That experience is reserved for the three little eyes of the bee. The other larger eyes do have some kind of normal light sensitivity, but it resembles a twilight condition. If this normal light is screened out, the animal then perceives more powerfully the presence of a color that brings about a chemical reaction, for example, ultraviolet, or one that creates no chemical reaction, infrared. At the end of the article referred to earlier, the authors promise future reports on their research with infrared light. To be sure, if bees are exposed to infrared light, they will act quite differently, since the chemical reactions no longer will occur. The facts reported in these experiments are correct, but you need to be quite clear in your minds that the conclusions arrived at by Forel and Kuhn are not correct. This is a very thoughtless way to carry out an experiment. But then people say that the findings have been proved beyond any doubt. Yes, they are, naturally, for a person who can ascribe a soul to a mousetrap. But for someone who knows just how far one can go, just how far thoughts may take one so that the experiment can be carried out properly, the authors of the article have not eliminated all reasonable objections to the proofs they have offered. In everyday affairs, we are not used to pursuing a matter at hand with such rigor. When people experience somewhere in their lives an insignificant matter, they can, as the saying goes, make a mountain out of a molehill. This also happens to our learned scientists. When they consider one aspect of an experiment, they do not stop thinking. Instead, they continue thinking about only that which lies directly before their eyes. From this can arise all sorts of fantastic nonsense. A molehill can become a mountain very easily. When modern science claims something to be true, it can do so only through its power. It controls all the scientific journals. As a result, no one generally will dare to contradict whatever has been presented. However, ultimately, you will not be able to do anything with all this nonsense. I personally believe that if you were to consult all existing beekeepers, you would find out that the best of them would concern themselves very little with the results that Forel and Kuhn published regarding their experiments with bees. This is so because beekeepers need to be practical above all. They do instinctively whatever they need to do. It would be much better if you really understood why these instinctive things are done. I think that I have generally noticed that a beekeeper might be interested enough to sit down and read such an article on a Sunday evening when it is snowing outside. But he will not be able to apply the information in any meaningful way. But you must certainly have some other interesting questions to ask me. Mr. Müller, I would like to add something about the queen bee. We've already talked about the fact that it lays eggs. But we also have unfertilized queen bees, for example, in bad weather, and from their eggs the worthless drones hatch. Likewise, the situation arises that when the queen has left, and no young brood is present any longer, the queen bees breed a bee to become a queen. This queen also lays eggs. But as it turns out, unfertilized eggs, from which arise worthless drones. Then I also would like to make a comment about swarming. The first swarm has no new queen bee. It is still sleeping in its cell. Only the older bees have left with their queen. By catching this queen, I can put all the bees of the swarm in the hive. In regard to the bee's ability to see, I would like to say that when we work in the bee house and there is too much light, which is never enough light for the beekeeper, the bees get overly excited. About the bees stinging when they are swarming, all our beekeepers know that a first swarm is rather ticklish, but the subsequent swarm is less so. Our opinion is that young bees don't sting, still don't use their stinger. There are some regions where people don't harvest honey before the priest has blessed the hives. August 8th is such a sacred honey day. It can also happen that a swarm flies out, that the queen takes up a position elsewhere, somewhere else. It then appears that the swarm is done for. But it isn't so. It isn't always completely the case. Dr. Steiner. Regarding what I said, it all seemed to be directed toward the fact that the old queen leaves its own community of bees when the young queen appears, specifically when it shows itself to the bees as a glowworm. When the swarm has swarmed out and you've caught the old queen, then you can bring the swarm back to the hive, and it will just continue functioning as it did before. You can't say that it is not true that the swarm on first impulse left on account of the strong impression of light the young queen made upon the three small eyes of each bee. You haven't eliminated that possibility entirely. You need to think very logically here. Let me give you an example from real life. Imagine that all of you were working somewhere for the same company. One day you decide to strike because the board of directors did something unjust. Let's assume you decide to strike, which is like swarming out. Now time passes, and you are no longer able to buy the groceries you need. You're suffering from hunger and are forced to return to work again. Well, can I now say that it isn't true that something unjust happened earlier? For now you must consider that if you remove the old queen from the swarm that left the hive, and put the swarm back into the hive, then the swarm will swallow the bitter pill that it no longer has its old queen, and will simply have to put up with the new queen, something it does sense. That's why what I said before isn't incorrect. Rather, it's a question of putting all these things in the proper perspective. Then you also spoke about premature swarming, where a young queen isn't there yet, where you really can't talk about something like that. Well, have you ever seen such a premature swarming if the egg of the young queen hasn't hatched? Mr. Mueller, 9 days before the young queen hatched. Dr. Steiner, at first, the young queen is in its cell, in the form of an egg. Table 4, upper right. After 16 days, she'll be an adult queen bee. At that point, she'll emerge from the egg. But 9 days earlier, she is either in the form of an embryo or a larva. The strange thing is that the egg, at that point, gives off the greatest amount of light. It gradually stops shining, and the young queen still shines for some time. Her strongest radiation appears when she is still an embryo or a larva. So it becomes quite clear why these premature swarms, consisting of the most sensitive bees, leave the hive. And that explains why nothing happens until a young queen appears. What is the young queen? She is already there, even if only in the form of an embryo. If the queen remains unfertilized, then she will not produce any workers, only drones, and, as Mr. Mueller said, on top of everything, they are bad drones. That's correct. You can't use the blood of an unfertilized pseudo-mother because there are no workers in it. You'll have to see to it that the bees carry out their nuptial flight specifically under the influence of sunlight. Now you see again what an important role the chemical element plays. For it's true, isn't it, that everything that happens is an effect exerted upon the sexual nature of bees. The nature of sex is, however, completely of a chemical kind. When the queen flies up high, naturally, light doesn't cause the influence directly, but rather it is the result of the chemical element present in the influence coming from the light. Here you can really see how supersensitive bees are to that which is chemical in nature. You also stated that if you are working with the hive, you as a human being need light. But the bees become restless and would prefer to work in the dark. Well, think about this very hard. The bee receives chemical effects from the light. It is affected chemically by the light. But it is the chemical effects that it senses, not the light as such. Now you come as a human being and allow light to shine on the bees. You suddenly introduce light, which affects bees, just as a strong draft would affect you if you were sitting somewhere and opened a window to allow a strong draft to enter. The bee senses the light. It doesn't sense that it is particularly bright, but it senses it more like a shock that causes it to be shaken up to the point of confusion. You could almost say, without my ever having observed this personally, that when the beekeeper allows too much light to fall into the hive, the bees will act extremely nervous because of the chemical effects of the light within their bodies, and they will begin to fly back and forth like small swallows. They dance back and forth. That's simply an indication that they feel in themselves a certain amount of restlessness. Imagine for a moment that the bees did not act restless in this way when they saw the light. They would tend to crawl away into corners so that the light would no longer affect them. In all these matters, you should be clear about the fact that these effects, which are present everywhere, should not be compared to the effects that these same things have upon human beings. In this case, you would anthropomorphize everything too much, and you would never get to the point of being able to imagine the whole matter in any other way than by saying that because the human being sees things this way, the animal too must see them the same way. You should not be allowed to say anything like that offhandedly. You probably have already experienced the following situation. Whoever has observed such things can perceive correctly what is going on. In your mind, put yourself into a kitchen, where there is an oven range plate that is slightly warm because of the pilot light directly beneath it. The cat likes to take up a position there, curls up, closes its eyes, and goes to sleep. Now, if somewhere under a kitchen cabinet there is a mouse that the cat can't see with its eyes, it can happen that the cat will jump down suddenly without having opened its eyes, and, with complete self-confidence, will leap right on top of the mouse. Before you've even had a chance to consider what is happening, the cat comes back with the mouse in its mouth. Well, gentlemen, you're not going to tell me that the cat saw the mouse. It had its eyes closed and was sleeping. Then other people will say, quote, "The cat has a very fine sense of hearing, and with this it was able to sense where the mouse was," unquote. Now you would have to reason as follows. The cat hears best of all when it sleeps. That is a rather questionable assertion, because seeing and hearing are those senses that generally play an important role only when the cat is awake, whereas the sense of smell plays an extraordinarily important role when the cat is asleep. This sense is based upon reacting to chemical processes. Something chemical happens in the nose and in the entire brain. And moreover, if you hear something, are you immediately prepared to jump with confidence in the right direction? That is certainly not the case. Hearing is not a sense you can orient yourself to so quickly. So it can't be a question of hearing in the case of the cat. But what you do definitely find in the cat is a very fine sense of smell, which it has right in its bristly whiskers. And this extremely fine sense of smell is in the whiskers, because each bristle contains a canal in which it is contained a substance, drawing on the back blackboard, that changes chemically when a mouse is present. If there isn't a mouse present, then the substance is in a certain chemical state. But if one is in the vicinity, even rather far away, then the cat will sense it through the chemical changes in its whiskers. I once told you about people who live on the fourth floor of a house, in the cellar of which some material, for example, buckwheat, is stored. Footnote: See lecture zur symptomatischen Betrachtung des Astralleibes. Sorry, April 14, 1923, entitled Vom Leben des Menschen und der Erde, GA 349, not published in English. End of footnote. These people can sense this material and become ill from it. People can easily come to the conclusion that the sense of smell can also function with great accuracy. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any police dogs. They actually do not achieve very much with their eyes, but can accomplish much with their sense of smell. So it turns out that in the animal kingdom, confidence in sense perception does not come from the eyes, but can instead be ascribed to chemical effects. And these effects are strongest of all in ultraviolet light. If you really wanted to help a police dog, it would be very beneficial to the dog for you to go along with it, shine on it a special spotlight that removes the visible color spectrum, and make sure that the dog is always within the beam of ultraviolet light. Then the police dog would pursue its quarry with even more confidence, because even greater chemical effects would occur in its scenting hairs. Yes, dogs also have whiskers for this purpose. Everything that you can know about animals points toward the fact that when you enter the animal kingdom, you need to look beyond such obvious and commonly referred to animal sense organs as sight and hearing, and you must delve into the senses of smell and taste. That means going down to the level of the chemical senses. You are also of the opinion that young bees don't sting. It could easily be explained that young bees simply haven't yet developed the mature organ for stinging, as well as all other inner organs. That will all come later, when it reaches maturity. There is nothing of particular importance about this, and it doesn't contradict what I've already said. Mr. Müller asks about feeding bees artificially. He takes 4 liters of water and 5 kilos of sugar, adds some thyme, chamomile tea, and a pinch of salt. What effects will that have? Dr. Steiner. We should be able to give quite a bit of information about that, because our homeopathic medicines are partially based upon such principles, according to which you acted instinctively. Not all but a number of our medications are based on them. If you feed bees sugar, it is actually, at first glance, a bit of nonsense. By nature, bees derive their nourishment from nectar and pollen, not from sugar. Mr. Müller. For example, we have to empty out everything in the apiary, even the combs with unhatched bees, because the bees will otherwise get dysentery. And then, sometimes the bees have only 2 to 3 kilos left at the end of the summer. That's not enough. Dr. Steiner. Generally, bees are not accustomed to eating sugar, since they normally have their honey as food. That's what they're used to taking in by nature. Now, the strange thing is that in winter, the bee will transform every type of food it receives into a kind of honey. Any animal will transform the nourishment it receives into something it can use. The bee does this as well. But you can imagine that transforming sugar into honey demands more energy from the bee than does eating its own honey. What kind of bees are those going to be that are capable of transforming larger quantities of sugar into honey? Those can only be the strong bees, the ones that you can well use. You won't be able to get weak bees to accomplish this transformation, and for that reason, they are more or less useless to humans. But remember what I said earlier. This whole procedure is understandable from an anthroposophic standpoint. If you add chamomile tea, for example, to the mixture, then you are already taking from the bee a part of the work it would normally have to carry out in its own body. If you mix sugar with this chamomile tea, the chemical substance of chamomile is that part of the plant that brings out the honey nectar within the plant. For the substance contained in chamomile tea is not only in the chamomile plant, but also in every plant that has honey nectar in it. The chamomile plant, however, contains this substance to a greater degree, and that's why you can't use it as a plant source for honey. But if you have, before you, a plant, there is in it a lot of so-called starch. This starch continually has the tendency of transforming itself into sugar. Now the juice of the chamomile plant already begins working on this starch in the plant in such a way that it directs the sugary juice within the plant to become more like honey. If you give the animal chamomile tea, you are supporting it this way in the inner honey effect that it creates. You are making the sugar more like honey when you add chamomile tea. This is how we also do it with our homeopathic medicines. If you have any kind of metal that you need to give as medicine, you can't give it to a person directly, because it would simply wander through the digestive system without being properly absorbed. What you need to do is compound it with something else, because then it will be more easily assimilated. That's the way it also is with the chamomile tea that you add to the sugar. Salt will also have to be added, because it is salt that makes digestible, otherwise indigestible things. Human beings instinctively add salt to soup, because salt has the unique property of spreading very fast within the body, which helps make food digestible. The end of Lecture 2.